This is the Lou Rockwell Show.
Well, it's great to have as our guest today Professor Roderick Long. Roderick teaches philosophy at Auburn University. He's a senior scholar of the Mises Institute, a famous libertarian. Take a look at his archive on Mises.org and also on LouRockwell.com. And Roderick, I don't want to accuse you of anything, but it's rumored that you're an anarchist. I mean, is that actually correct?
Yes. There is some truth to the rumor.
What does that mean?
Well, if an anarchist in this context is someone who wants to abolish the state, where the state is understood not as law and order. As an anarchist, I have no objection to law and order. I'd like to see more of it. But as the state is a territorial monopolist of law and order, just as a shoe monopolist could be someone who says, no one is allowed to make shoes except me, and I will decide what shoes you get and how much you pay for it. So a government is an institution that says, no one's allowed to produce any law and order except me in this area, and I will decide what kind of laws you get, what kind of order you get, and how much you pay for it. And if you don't like it, well, every 4 or 6 years you can, petition for some change in the personnel of my company.
It's a great description of the state. So, but of course the state does more than just give us law and order here at home. They give us law and order all over the world.
Yeah, and well, I mean, think about it this way. If you are, if you're in a position where you are the, you're in a position to where you control all these, all this weapons, you have all this power, and no one's allowed to compete with you. Well, then, you're in a position to do a heck of a lot of things you'd like to do. And of course, you'll probably try to describe these things as being in some way pursuant to what your goals are supposed to be. So if the function of the government is supposed to be protection of people's rights, which is what they often claim to be doing, then of course, these other things they do, they'll try to spin as protection of people's rights. But monopolies are in a position to abuse their power and to divert the resources they've acquired to various purposes, and so if they want to invade various countries, just like the invasion of Iraq, which was advertised as a defense of our rights, though it was never clear how it was supposed to be. There was a suggestion that it had something to do with defending us against the 9/11 terrorists who were not from Iraq. Also, there was a suggestion that it was the defense of the Iraqi people's rights. They were going there to liberate them. And successfully, succeeded in liberating hundreds and thousands of them of their lives, but when you're a monopoly, you're in a position to do this because you don't have competition. If I were a shoe company and I started making shoes that had spikes on the inside of them that would poke at you, but those are the only shoes that that people are allowed to have. Obviously, if another shoe company could come in and start having the shoes that didn't have spikes on the inside of them, then the shoe company would lose its ability to have any customers. But as long as the spikes aren't too sharp, that you're better off with that than going barefoot, people will put up with it.
What about the typical statist claim of public goods, that there are some things that are necessary to society that won't be produced in the private market, and so therefore you have to have the government to do it?
Yeah, well, the idea behind public goods is supposed to be that there are cases where, although it's in everyone's interest that a good be produced, it'll be produced whether any individual contributes to it or not, if it gets produced. And so people will just try to free ride in the production of the good, and therefore not enough people will contribute to it, and so it won't be produced or won't be produced in adequate quantities. There are a couple of problems with this argument. First is it ignores the fact that whenever you have a situation like that, you're creating an incentive for somebody, some entrepreneur or someone, to figure out a way to produce the good, because you have this profit opportunity that if there's something a lot of people want, but there's some problem with getting it produced, if you can figure out how to produce it, you stand to make a lot of money. And so when we actually look throughout history, you find that lots of things that are supposed to be public goods that there's no way of privately producing, people do manage to produce them privately because people who stand to make a profit for it can often think up ways of doing it that someone sitting in their ivory tower can't. But the second problem with it is that it ignores the fact that government has another kind of incentive problem, which is, we might say, public choice problems, which is that when you're in a position to have a monopoly and abuse power, then you're there's no check on doing that. And so government has these sort of perverse and incentive factors, plus perverse informational factors, where in the absence of competition, even if the government has good intentions, they're not, they have a hard time knowing whether they're doing the best thing. So we have to compare the so-called perversities of of the market with the perversities of government. And then, you know, the perversities of the market, if you want to call them that, have a built-in correcting factor, which is that entrepreneurs stand to make a profit if they can figure out how to solve them. Whereas government doesn't have this kind of inbuilt correcting factor, because generally the way things work in government is the more something fails, the more money it gets thrown at it. You know, we hear, well, that our public schools are failing, we need to fund them more. In the market, when something does less well, it gets less money thrown at it, and things that do better get more money thrown at them. And that tends to encourage a better kind of incentive. But in government, the worse you do, the more money you get. And, so it's no surprise that, governments behave incompetently.
Roderick, what were your intellectual influences? I mean, what helped bring you, not just in general, but helped bring you to these political and economic conclusions?
I was raised in a family that you might call sort of broadly old right, and sort of the conservative movement as it used to be, much more of sort of an anti-state movement that was very skeptical of Roosevelt and that sort of thing. But I was growing up, as a kid, I was very, unpolitical. I remember when I was in grade school, taking some kind of test of general knowledge, and I scored pretty high in everything except when it came to the political stuff. I had no idea like who the Secretary of State was or anything like that. I was just sort of complete blank. Then in high school, I read Ayn Rand, and that was sort of the beginning of getting interested in libertarian ideas, although she was certainly not an anarchist, but a lot of people think that her ideas logically lead to anarchism, whether she recognized that or not. And then, it's sort of a typical way of getting involved in libertarianism is, we read her articles and you see various things that she refers to, and you go and read them and you see various other things you refer to. So I ended up reading, Murray Rothbard and Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek and David Friedman and Friedrich Bastiat and, sort of the usual intellectual influences. It took me a fairly long time to become an anarchist, partly because I had one of the people I read that reading Rand had brought me to was Isabel Patterson. And Isabel Patterson has this argument that having a political structure is crucial to any kind of viable society. And she convinced me of that, and I think she was right about that, except that she thought, and therefore I thought, that having a political structure was inconsistent with anarchism. What I didn't realize is that anarchism is itself a political structure. It's checks and balances taken to its logical extreme. After all, some governments work better than others. The ones that tend to work better than others are the ones that have some sorts of checks and balances built into them, some ways in which it's harder for certain parts of the government to abuse power because other parts of the government have some sort of incentive to check them. Well, if you take that to its logical conclusion, you get the idea that If you want something, it's a way of sort of trying to reproduce competition into government. Well, then the logical extension of that is to extend competition broadly by allowing anyone to get into the business of providing legal services. But it took me a long time to realize that. So although I became a libertarian in some sense in 1979, I didn't really become an anarchist until 1991, something like that. Took me a long time. Read various things. Read Randy Barnett and Murray Rothbard and Bruce Benson, and looking at historical examples and theoretical arguments. And finally, it was actually during the first Gulf War that I finally flipped over. I just sort of enough already. And one of the things that happened was that I remember there was a news report that there was a situation of anarchy in Kuwait where the emir was unable to exercise power, but the Iraqi troops were gone, and it was a temporary period where the news reports were saying things were at least sort of temporarily self-organizing. It didn't last, but I remember sort of being surprised by a reaction of thinking, "Hey, I wish that would last longer." And I thought, "Wait a second, I'm not an anarchist," and like, "Well, but why am I not an anarchist?" And I think it was around that time that I finally made the leap.
You know, we seem to have had this, what Murray Rothbard called a band of thieves writ large. The state hung around our necks through all of human history or all of known history. Have there been instances when that was not the case?
Yeah, there's never been a society of precisely the kind that libertarian anarchists advocate. But there certainly have been many societies that didn't have a monopoly state as we know it, and many of these societies did fairly well. In fact, there's a sense in which, and depending on exactly how you define the state, there's a sense in which there were very few states in early history, in the sense that, for example, most ancient societies had nothing we would recognize as a police force. What was policing was basically done by sort of private action. But in particular, if you look at cases like England before the Norman Conquest, or medieval Iceland, or medieval Ireland, you find various cases where there wasn't really anything in the way of a monopoly state. You had legal services. Take the case of Iceland. You could sign it. There was a legislature, so it wasn't completely competitive. There was a single legislature, but you could sign up with who you wanted your representative in the legislature to be, and you didn't have to change your location to do it. So it's like, you could just say, suppose that you the analog in our country would be if you could switch who your representative in Congress was without switching what state or what district you live in. There was no executive branch in Iceland. There was no president. There was no there were no police. There was this legislature, you could sign up with and your representative also provided sort of protection services, but you could switch from one protector to another without changing your location. So it had a competitive aspect. It didn't have anything that we would call a state. Likewise, people talk about the Wild West. The Wild West really wasn't quite as wild as people say. At least many parts of it weren't. And although nominally the United States government was the authority out there, there were lots of places where the United States government just wasn't anywhere to be seen in terms of actual representatives. And you find these local groups. Historically, they get called vigilante groups. But if you look at how some of them operated, the vigilante groups, they would capture a they would capture a criminal, try him, and sometimes they would find him not guilty and let him go, which shows that they weren't the way you sort of picture vigilante groups as being. And places were also where there are no judges, and so if two people have a dispute, they'd often sort of, each side would pick someone that they trusted to arbitrate the dispute. Those two people would pick a third one, and they'd arbitrate the dispute, lots of places people had to find ways of ensuring legal cooperation for themselves because the state wasn't there. And of course, once you've got society and economy going, then the state moves in and says, oh, okay, now I'm in charge of all this. But they often, the state really isn't the source of order in society. It just sort of comes along as a parasite on top of that order. This great line from I think it's the British anarchist Colin Ward saying, "Anarchy is the cement that holds society together. It's voluntary exchange is the or Thomas Paine at the beginning of the second half of Rights of Man says that the chief source of order in society is not government. The chief source of order in society is the fact that human beings cooperate. A, because we're naturally social beings, and B, because it's in our self-interest to cooperate. And those two factors lead to most of the order in society," Paine thought. And then Paine wasn't an anarchist. He thought that you did need government, but he thought that most of the order in society would survive even if you didn't have it. And part of his evidence was, he said, well, look at during the American Revolution, when the British government really wasn't operating, but the local colonial governments really hadn't gotten their act together particularly either. And he says, well, people still brought their goods to market and so forth. Society, did fairly well during the revolution, in the areas where there wasn't actual fighting. Society was going on as before. Actually, Sir Edmund Burke, oddly enough, makes the same point in his speech on conciliation with the colonies in the Parliament. He says, we thought that without government, the colonies would quickly, run into collapse and come crying back to us, and they're not. And we'd better make an agreement with them quickly before they decide that that anarchy is tolerable. There have been a number of historical cases. There really is no case of any so-called public good that hasn't been provided privately at one time or another.
In fact, Murray Rothbard argues that Burke was at one time himself an anarchist.
Yeah, Burke has there's an early piece of Burke's called The Vindication of Natural Society, where he argues in favor of anarchism. And then Burke later claimed that this was a joke. There was a satire against Bolingbroke, and some people thought it was a satire against Rousseau. But you know, other people have noted that it doesn't really look exactly like a satire. And there are some interesting similarities between it and some of his other early writings that people don't think are satirical. So it's hard to know exactly what he was doing. It may not have been entirely sincere, but he may have been sort of playing with ideas that he was, at least to some extent, tempted by, or he's trying to see where they would lead. At any rate, it seems too similar to some of his early writings to be completely satirical. On the other hand, it is in some tension with some of his early writings, and so it's hard to know what to make of it. But as a satire, it's not very, it's not very interesting as a satire. Whereas it's a, it's a pretty good, it's a pretty good argument as it stands. Some people call him sort of the first, call it the sort of the first modern, anarchist manifesto. I'm not sure whether it really is the first. It's so far hard to find first, because you can find various people, earlier, you can always find someone earlier who seems to have had some part of the idea, but Burkhardt does seem to have oddly at least contributed something interesting to this literature.
Burke's Vindication of a Natural Society is on lewrockwell.com. You can just put Burke into Google there and find it. Murray Rothbard argued that it was, not satire, although this is, I guess, the typical Burke scholar agrees with the satirical point.
Yeah, the majority view among Burke scholars is that it's satirical, although Isaac Kramnik, in his biography of Burke called The Rage of Edmund Burke, Portrait of an Ambivalent Conservative, he has a section where he talks about Rothbard's article, and although he doesn't go as far as Rothbard, he thinks that Rothbard had a good point, and he thinks that so he makes the case by comparing The Vindication with other early writings of Burke that no one ever reads. He makes the case that it couldn't have been as satirical as most Burke scholars think. But I haven't seen any Burke scholars really responding to Kramnik's, argument in there, because I still see, when you see it in anthologies of Burke's early writings, the introduction always, just says, oh, and this is a satirical work, and doesn't seem to be aware of this other argument.
Roderick, you wrote a famous article in defense of anarchism. Walter Block calls it the best article ever written in favor of anarchism.
Replies to 10 Objections to Libertarian Anarchism. It's on Mises.org. It's on lewrockwell.com. So if you just Google, Roderick Long objections libertarian anarchism, some combination of those words, it'll probably come up. And what I did was I ran through a bunch of the standard objections to libertarian anarchism and tried to give arguments against them. This was a talk that I gave at the Mises Institute. I think it was the time I was a mystery speaker at a conference.
Roderick Long, thanks so much for being with us today. Take a look at his archive at Mises.org. Take a look at his archive at lewrockwell.com. And especially take a look at his refutation of 10 Objections to Anarchism. Roderick, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by lewrockwell.com. The best-read libertarian website in the world. If you'd like to advertise on this podcast or on the website, email advertise@lewrockwell.com. And thanks for listening.